This is the AMPIC Cyber Critical Assets Podcast. Each episode, we cover important OT and ICS security topics with an eye toward standards and regulation to keep you ahead of your adversaries and your auditors. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Critical Assets Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Miller, CEO at AMPIC Cyber. And today with me, I have a longtime friend, Darren Heifel. And we're going to talk about kind of lessons from the field as a CISO. It's not often that we actually get a chance to hear from a real CISO that's been a CISO for a while with lots of good industrial industry experience. So I wanted to give everybody a chance to kind of peek behind the CISO curtain and get a conversation with someone who's done this for a while. So Darren, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I've known you for a long time, but those who don't know you, I mean, you've been part of the S4 community and like you've been around a while, but let's get a little bit about your background and how you got into cybersecurity.
Sure. So I first got into cybersecurity, at least in the consulting context in the early 2000s, got hired by a little boutique power engineering firm in Knoxville, Tennessee called Internex. They were actually looking for a software engineer to help them write some of their tools, their analysis tools. And before long, they figured out that that they could stick me in front of a client. They actually had a lot of really cool connections to standards community and whatnot. And I started to learn about how the grid operates from them. And they opened some doors for me. And I wound up leading a fair amount of industry collaborative efforts around smart grid security in the 2000s.
I remember that.
Bebop my way through a couple of different consulting engagements, consulting opportunities, and then in 2017 took the job as the chief information security officer for Norfolk Southern, the railroad that, along with CSX, covers the eastern half of the United States. And was there up until about a year ago when I took a voluntary separation package.
I remember the old smart grid days. I remember Internex. Yeah, that takes me back. Pepperidge Farms remembers. Okay, so tell me some of the pivotal moments in your career that kind of led you to where you are today. We talked a little bit about that, but I mean, you went from consultant to CISO. There's got to be something in there that was more like the kind of hinge moments that really put you in that CISO role from consultant space.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I mean, backing up just a little bit, I will say that even getting the role at Internex was pretty pivotal. Prior to that, you know, I was just doing software engineering. I had an affinity for doing security related stuff and had managed to land myself a software engineering job where we needed to deploy stuff into a secure environment. So I had a reason to teach myself more about security. But then really, it was really when I took the job at Internex. When I took that job, I didn't know the first thing about the grid. I remember when I applied to it, I had no idea if Internex was a utility or, you know, what they were. I didn't know the first thing. I had no idea that there was a difference between distribution and transmission lines or anything along the, I had no idea how the grid worked. And I was fortunate enough to join a team that was very happy to share knowledge and was extremely knowledgeable. Between Eric Gunther and Grant Gilchrist, the two of them taught me a tremendous amount about how the grid works. And, you know, just figuring out from there that, hey, you know, you start to learn that industrial control systems, operations technology, it's its own little thing in terms of security considerations. And so then we were off and running. But to your point, you know, one of the things that, as I mentioned, they opened up some opportunities for me in the industry collaborative space around standards and both national and international standards. And so I really got to know the standards around cybersecurity, including ultimately the NIST cybersecurity framework. And it was in a consulting context where I received a cold request for proposal, RFP, from Norfolk Southern to do an assessment of their program against the NIST cybersecurity framework. And I said, hey, I know how to do that. made the pitch for that. We did a good enough job that they brought us back for more and more work. So I really got to know the Norfolk Southern team in the context of evaluating the cybersecurity program. Figured out it was a really good match on the cultural front. And so then when their director of cybersecurity at the time, Marty Battaglio, when he got promoted to AVP or Assistant Vice President of Application Development, called to share the good news with me. And I was like, woohoo, way to go, Marty. And then he said, by the way, you know anybody be interested in the CISO position? And so I said, sure enough, I think I do. So next thing you know, I went through, I mean, legitimate interview process, but they knew me, I knew them,
Okay.
and it was pretty well set up at that point.
Okay. In the CISO role, because prior to that, it was mostly consulting. With that experience, what are some of the biggest challenges you faced in that role? I mean, everybody has lots of, perceptions about that, but what, not just in the day-to-day, but in like the arc of being the multiple years as a CISO, what were like some of the biggest like milestone, monumental challenges, not just the tactical stuff?
Yeah, I mean the biggest stuff really is getting the time and attention of the business leaders. You know, as a consultant, that's really you kind of get that as part of the gig. You know, they're paying you good money, and so you know they're not gonna waste anybody's time with the clock ticking like that. So you do get those audiences, maybe not everyone that you want, but you do get face time with business leaders through that mechanism. Once you're actually in the seat, it's a little bit different dynamic. You know, the business leaders, they got jobs to do. They got stuff to take care of. And some cybersecurity practitioner coming along and trying to tell them, hey, slow down, or I need to insert this in your process or whatever else, is not always, you know, the most welcome conversation. So getting in front of them can be a little bit challenging. You know, telling them about the risks of getting hacked is just not it's not the sales point that you might think it might be. So you really have to understand their world in order to make the case for cyber, to put the risk in their terms so that they can actually understand what it is that you're talking about.
Okay. How big was your team?
Yeah, when I started, the team I think was around 26 or 27 folks with two managers. By the time I left about a year ago, we were closing it. We were pretty close to 60,
Okay.
and had six managers and a director.
Pretty significant size team.
Yeah, I think, you know, it really, I think structuring the program around the NIST cybersecurity framework really went a long ways to help kind of justify where we needed what kind of resources and how to show how that mapped up to the different functions that we were performing and the services that we were providing to the business. It was a really effective framework to help us manage the overall program.
I make the same recommendation as well all the time. Manage to a framework. It's just much easier to measure and show progress and not in those cases. Now, sensitive question. You can choose to answer however you want, but did you have any incidents you had to go through?
Actually, I will say I was incredibly fortunate that I had no major incidents on my watch. We did have, you know, we did have an assortment of, you know, minor things, and certainly no shortage of all night or late night bridge lines or whatever, trying to chase stuff down. But all of it wound up being, you know, pretty minor, or sometimes it wasn't even a cyber event. You know, sometimes it was just some kind of a fluke or error or outage or something along those lines. So I really attribute that to a couple things. I do think we had a solid foundation for the program. I also went about the job very deliberately with a low profile. Whereas when I had been a consultant, I really tried to get my name and my message and my words out there, you know, to kind of socialize and advertise. As soon as I took the CISO job, that all just completely went away. And I really kept my head down, really did not want to draw attention to myself, and did that very deliberately. And then the last thing that I'll attribute to is I think we just got lucky. There's a certain amount of going on the just the roulette wheel that's involved when you're in that kind of a position. And I'll take luck over being good any day.
Right. It's always a nice contributing factor.
I will mention though that there was one not cybersecurity incident that we encountered that was very interesting. It was so you may recall some years ago we had a little boo-boo up in a town in Ohio called East Palestine.
I remember this.
And shortly after that, the news cycle started to change and move on. I think there was some weather balloon that we were all excited about drifting over the United States. And we started to breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief. But then all of a sudden, the news cycle kicked back up, and all of a sudden, we were right back in the crosshairs of the news cycle. And essentially, we were turned into a political football.
Yeah.
And that really, we started having team members that were getting threats through social media. We had executives that were starting to be targeted. And so now all of a sudden, my job became much more interesting in just helping the team members and the executives figure out how do they stay safe? How do they keep their accounts safe? How do we reassure the board that we are, have our eyes wide open on everything in front of us and make sure that we have everything locked down?
Wow. I was thinking about you when that happened, but I figured trying to call you and find out what's going on right now is not a good idea. It's like, hey, man, I know you're slammed. Tell me what's happened. Yeah. Well,
It
okay.
was some interesting times.
I can imagine. Yeah. Interesting times in the Chinese curse kind of way. Now, you mentioned a little bit about this earlier, but you're constantly trying to balance the business objectives with the security priorities. And you see the threats and risks in ways and understand them in ways that nobody else in the business does. So they're going to come back at you with, hey, you don't understand my business priority like I do. So there's this constant, and not only say tug of war, but delicate balance between managing those risks and the business priorities. How did you navigate that? What was your strategy? Like,
Yeah, I
what's
think.
the secret sauce to success there?
No, I think the interesting bit is that if you're not wrong at all. There's a natural tension there, but I think a lot of it comes down to the mindset, because if you view it as a balance and if you view it as a tension, then to some extent you're setting up your own failure. There is a mandatory degree to where you need enough info to make, to make informed decisions. And that means that for any risk evaluation, there's a certain minimum floor of information that you need in order to make that decision. And sometimes even that can be a little bit contentious. But the bottom line is that the security objectives really should inherently align with the business objectives. So, how do you get security into the business objectives? Well, you understand the business and you build security to serve the business. So once you actually start structuring your security objectives to where they are directly aligned with the business objectives, it becomes much less of a tug of war.
Good advice. So let's see. There's a lot of the discussions in, I'm going to shift a little bit to the OT aspect versus some of the IT components, because we do lean a little bit into the IT space, but mostly where it's IT-ish OT. So a lot of the discussions in cyber do focus on the IT side, but your work's included a lot of OT. From that differential into the OT space, what are some of the unique OT challenges for a CISO?
So I think, if you're, it's it was interesting, once you get into the CISO ranks, you do have these access to these forums where you're in with a lot of your peers, CISOs for other companies. And an awful lot of those companies do not have operations technology. They don't have control systems. And so their point of view and their experience is all around IT. And so you get a very particular lens to understand how do you draw that distinction? What is it that really hamstrings you on the OT front? And it all comes down to really just how OT works in a business. The whole reason that a business has operations technology is because the business model fundamentally depends on it. And this is frequently technology that is purpose-built for that business. So it winds up being essential to the business process. It winds up being oftentimes custom built, so it's expensive, or if it's it may not be custom built, but it's built for a very narrow market. And anytime that you have a low volume, high effort product, it's going to be very expensive. And so these businesses, when they're buying these systems that are purpose built for them, that their business depends on it, and they're spending a lot of money on it, they're going to capitalize it and do everything they can to get the absolute most use out of those systems. And so they wind up being in place for a long time. So you have very long deployment life cycles. And that combined with the small production market are the two biggest factors that I found that really shape operations technology security.
Okay, I've run into this recently. There are IT CISOs are either stepping into a job that's got OT, or they're basically inheriting the OT as the CISO role is created, but they did not come from that background. So those situations are happening pretty frequently. I mean, more than I would have expected, just based on the conversations I'm having. If you had to give some advice to an IT-centered or IT, historical IT CISO that just maybe just inherited OT or just took an OT, has an OT role now, if you could give them like one thing, don't forget this one thing, what would that be?
Ooh, that's a fantastic question. And I think really what it boils down to is that you have now moved several notches closer to the epicenter of the business. The operations technology is the lifeblood of that's how the business makes money. And when operations technology goes down, the bill starts racking up very, very quickly. And it's not like, oh, well, you don't have email, or I don't have access to file share or something along those lines. When the production line is down, it is all hands on deck, 24/7, 365, and then some, until you get it working again. And so anything that you do to either slow that down or disrupt that, you are now viewed as the adversary. So you have to have a lot of contextual awareness, and there's a lot of implications in terms of how you interact with those business leaders accordingly.
I totally agree. It's the one thing that I think most IT people don't know, that like dollars per second of downtime of the plant floor or of the facility, whatever it is, whether it's a generation plant or a refinery or a water operation. The OT CISOs know that number. That's like you need to know that number because that will guide a lot of your decision-making processes and many other aspects to the job.
When trains come to a stop across the entire eastern half of the country, you got a lot of eyeballs on it really quick.
I'm sure. Phone calls from places you really don't want to get phone calls from.
Exactly.
Okay, now in staying in the OT thread, have you seen a shift in how organizations are approaching OT security at that level, right? I mean, not the tactical level or the tech, base technology levels, but from a CISO or CSO strategic organizational, security level, are they changing any approaches now? Or at least, is there any trends that you're seeing?
I'm seeing some gradual shifts. I don't know that I'm seeing anything that is really profound or a step change, but I am seeing increased awareness of the impact of security on operations technology. We've in the last I remember, for the better part of a decade, the first decade that you and I knew each other, one of the biggest challenges of our industry was trying to convince folks that the challenge was real. Because there were not cybersecurity attacks that took down operations technology.
Oh no, and they all
And
come back with, we're air gapped. I'm like, no, you're not.
then And then the most bizarre thing in the world happened with Stuxnet, you know, where not only was it an OT attack, but it was an OT attack that like blew any movie plot, you know, way out of the water. It was so far off the charts, we couldn't even, it was almost surreal. It was almost as challenging to convince people that it was real because it was so bizarre. And then we've seen some other attacks since then. So we are seeing a more of an acceptance that, hey, this is a challenge that really needs to be addressed. Accordingly, I think we're starting to see some slow and careful incorporation of IT security practices into OT. We are starting to see some modernization of operations technology incorporating some more IT practices, but it's a gradual change. It's not a step change.
Okay, well, it's good to hear that at least that things are getting better, I guess is a good way to put it. Now, if there are on the flip side, kind of, or conversely, what do you think like the biggest gaps are right now from that perspective, from the CISO's perspective, gaps in maybe protecting critical infrastructure, for example?
The biggest gap is the same gap it's been all along, which is the whole procurement build security in gap. We talk about, you know, build security in from the start, and I think very few people really understand just how far left in the process that really needs to start, because the cycle starts with business objectives. You know, when you get executives just having lunch with vendors and brainstorming over what's the next bit of business functionality that they want to actually create or stand up, that's the point where the CISO needs to, you know, really needs to be in the conversation or start to get their leadership into the conversation. It's way before requirements gathering, and the security team really needs that same understanding of business objectives as the business has. And once the security team has that, well, then the security team can offer up solutions that are a whole lot easier to incorporate at that point in the discussion life cycle, whole lot easier to implement, cheaper to implement, and then you don't wind up with the last minute, oh, wait, we need to check this security box, and pressures of the timelines just steamroll right over top of that.
They just want you to put the security sticker on it as it comes off the end of the line.
That's it.
Okay. All right. Now let's shift a bit over to the threat side. I'm sure you got visibility into a lot of those things, given the, where you were and the position you had. So, kind of looking back over that span, how have the threats evolved over that time, or have they?
I think they have, but largely I think they have evolved with the technology. I don't know that threats have fundamentally changed over the course. It's really just, you know, as technology changes, the threats are going to change. And so, an inevitable job of the CISO or anybody in technology is you have to stay current. Now, one of the things that does change more gradually over time is the interconnections. You have to be, you know, as more and more technology spreads around and you get solutions all over the place, you find more and more points of interconnection, interdependency. And so staying on top of that map is tricky. The other thing that I will say is that geopolitics has become more of a point of discussion within especially operations technology, because you have to figure out what kind of threat actor is actually looking at you. What kind of threat actor is considering, you know, and evaluating if you are worth their time to attack, and what kind of resources are they willing to expend to get what kind of result? So that's something that has that I don't know it was on the map when I started the CISO journey, but it became much more of a part of the picture by the time I left that office.
I think there's been a shift in the merging or the collaboration or cooperation or commingling between organized crime and nation state actors, where we used to have a bigger separation between things like the, you know, the whole business line of initial access brokers, and then who they would sell to was usually not the nation state actors, but it was at some point. And then that just really kind of the lines just blurred. So we've got the landscape kind of got really messy. And I, at the same time, I think there was this kind of general conception that if you attacked critical infrastructure, that there would be some sort of like kinetic response to that. Like that was kind of like a line you didn't cross, you know what I mean? And then it got crossed and nobody cared. No one really did anything
Well,
about it. I mean,
yeah, I
don't
think.
get me wrong, they cared, but there was no real like kinetic response. There was no outrageous sort of really direct and reciprocal level of, or at least at what everybody had the expectation. It was really underwhelming in terms of what we expected the response would be and what it actually was.
Yeah, no, I think you've summarized it. You've summarized it well, and actually that is the formula. And the reason that you didn't see those kinetic responses was because of that whole space became grayscale. It wasn't black and white anymore. You couldn't easily put your finger on it and say it was this geopolitical adversary. Well, no, we largely think it was from the motivation standpoint, and we think they were who were kind of shielding or enabling this group that actually did the thing. And then, plausible deniability is a deadly phrase in this context.
And the challenges of attribution.
Yep.
Okay. Well, okay, that's good. That's good. And then let's see, if you had to give some advice to another CISO that's coming in, like don't forget about these threats. Don't just like this is a super, super important threat area for you to make sure you're watching.
Yeah, I mean, the everything is getting, I mean, everyone is getting more sophisticated. We are seeing offense. I mean, the classic cat and mouse game,
Arms
offense and
race.
defense, they evolve in parallel, but in individual lurches. One will lurch ahead, another then turns around and lurches back ahead, and that does create momentary gaps that you have to be very much aware of and stay on top of. But fundamentally, trickery and fraud is still trickery and fraud. There's an increased tech landscape that creates more overlaps and corners and edge conditions. And then, it's understanding how that risk translates across technology and touches different business functions.
Okay, I'm so glad you didn't just blurt out AI and leave it at that.
Well, I will say, AI does actually give me a bit of concern because it does make it easier. It's made reconnaissance really, really easy
Oh, yeah.
and opened up access to reconnaissance to a much broader audience. And it also makes fraud and trickery more universally accessible. You can take language and cultural barriers out of the mix much more easily. And, to date, we've been fortunate in that AI just kind of acts like a high fidelity mirror. You ever see a wild animal walk in front of a mirror for the first time and they get startled? That's what it's felt like our experience with AI has been so far. Where it goes next when the other side of the mirror is doing its own thing, that gets a little bit concerning, a little bit scary.
That's going to be a different podcast. We have so much more to go over on that space. All right. So, what I do want to do is I want to touch a little bit on this, the business aspect a little bit more. I've done, like the leadership thing at S4 for the on-ramp, this is super interesting for me because I think not just the CISO side, but the rest of the security like stack, the professional stack, right down from the frontline analyst all the way up to the management ranks, up to the CISO, into the executive layer and the board even. There's this communication issue, I think, in a lot of cases. And it's really about translating that technical cyber risk that the cyber folks really understand in bits and bytes and zeros and ones and protocols up to the business risk that the business understands in dollars and cents and downtime and risk management and insurance and all those things. How do you bridge that gap? Like, what are some tips you can give to, like I said, that entire security stack on how to make that successful?
I think the critical element is figuring out how to wear the business hat, how to, instead of coming at it from the cyber practitioner's perspective, trying to understand the business practitioner's perspective, understand how business technology works. When you think about your business counterpart, what are the risks that they are worried about? What are the uptime risks that they are worried about? What are the risks to the business that they worry about? And then start and then put your cybersecurity hat back on and start thinking, all right, well, if I was an attacker, how would I target those risks that that the business practitioner is actually worried about? And when you go down that path, it really teaches you to speak the language of the business, and to put what we do into that frame of reference that they can understand. It's really learning exactly how the business does business is the way that you communicate cyber into it. Because we know how to speak cyber.
Right. I think that's the hardest part is learning that language and learning how to translate into that language in a meaningful way. And then and not only that, but kind of convey it in confidence, right? In a way that they re that actually resonates with them. So
Absolutely. Absolutely.
your team grew significantly over time. What that tells me as an, just from an outside perspective is that somehow you were able to get a significant increase in budget. And not a lot of security CISOs or managers out there have an easy time with that situation. Some executives get it, some boards get it, and they just say, great, that sounds good, go do it. Other ones are like, hey, we haven't been hacked yet. So what's the problem? Why are you complaining about this? They come back with things like, every single year you come back for an increase. Why are we adding more security? But somehow we're like not more secure every year. All of these standard arguments that push back, because I'm sure you've seen them as well. So what was your trick? I mean, I'm sure it was an array of things, but like in generally speaking, how did you get that level of an increase in your program?
It really boiled down to identifying, the NIST CSF as that authoritative frame of
Okay.
reference
Yeah.
as, hey, this is what critical inf this document is from the government that says here are the functions that critical infrastructure needs to perform to protect it on the cybersecurity front. This is the document that everybody else, all of our peers are using. And it's so establishing that authoritative reference and then connecting the dots between here's what we're doing and here's how we measure up to that frame of reference and say we're doing X pretty well, we do Y mediocre, Z we don't even have at all. We need somebody that to step in there and start doing that function. And then when you can connect those dots to how the security organization is serving the business and help them understand that the lack of team members or personnel in those functions isn't just putting the company at risk, it's slowing the company down because we don't have the bandwidth to be able to serve the company the way that we needed to.
Okay, good. I'm glad you didn't say like, return on security investment or something like that.
There is that too, but that's not the approach that I found most successful.
Good. Well, I'm a firm believer in that approach and I use the same one. So you're gonna get a hallelujah from me on that approach, definitely. For the CISO role itself, what qualities do you think a person needs professionally, personally, to fit into that spot, right? We'll call it security manager, but the CISO-ish kind of thing. Like, what are the things you're looking for? If you were an executive or a board member and you were going to go hire one, what would you look for?
Yeah, I think the classic perception is that you look for somebody that's strong in security, and I really don't know that that's a minor piece of the puzzle, in all
Okay.
honesty.
Okay.
It's really about your ability to understand the business, the ability to speak in business terms and paint a compelling vision, and then a lot of the rest of it is just being it's being a good leader, knowing how to establish and build and create relationships both inside the org and outside the org, whether with vendors, with government, with standards bodies. It's listening to your team, how to ask the right questions, how to identify hotspots and gaps. It's really just a matter of security. But I come back to understanding the business. Because security is always security of something. Security is
Okay.
a quality modifier. It's not it security as a standalone thing doesn't make any sense. It's always what are you securing? And that's what you have to understand.
Okay. So when I hear this, tell me if I'm hearing it wrong. It almost sounds as though the soft skills are equally, maybe even more important than the technical skills.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to
Wow.
have enough technical wherewithal
Sure.
to be able to understand the right questions and to be able to discern when somebody is feeding you a line that doesn't make any sense. To be able to spot to be able to spot the nonsense. But even that, I've known many leaders that are good at spotting nonsense even when they have no technical understanding of the domain.
Yeah.
So really, it really does. I think you nailed it. It's the soft skills.
Okay, awesome. Now, for the CISO role, traditionally it's been kind of like a subordinate role, and it's starting to get to a place where it's an actual officer. The O means something. Now, I think since Tim Brown, a lot of CISOs are like, hey, if it doesn't come with directors and officers insurance, then I'm not going to do it. At least that's like one trend I'm seeing. What other trends are you seeing that are like what's kind of like the arc or the future arc of where the CISO role is going?
Well, I mean, I think we've covered an awful lot of it here
Okay.
today. It's the role of the business leader, and then a baseline. I mean, we're already at the point where there's a baseline expectation that the CISO can talk business and can relate to the board of directors. If you're a CISO today and you're struggling on that front, you're going to struggle as a CISO. So you do have to operate as a business leader, and you see all of the trade publications and magazine articles talking about that as well. It's really about being in tune with the business, being able to speak the language of risk. But more to your point, I think we're still in the days. I was expecting, in all honesty, more fallout from the SEC and
Yeah.
everything else. I was expecting more fallout by now. In all honesty, the conversations are ongoing. But they are all over the map. There's a wide variety of situations out there where some organizations completely and totally get it. The CISO is a full outright officer of the company. They're protected with D&O, all of those kinds of things. And then you've got other organizations, surprisingly large, impactful organizations that may say, yeah, we don't really, yeah, not so much. We're not seeing the need for that. And they just find, some poor individual that is honestly setting themselves up for an extraordinary amount of personal risk if
Yes.
you sign on to a position and don't have that protection.
Yeah. If you could give like that one piece of advice to the next generation of professionals that are looking to probably get down this path, not necessarily the CISO role itself, but if you wanted to progress that way in your career, what advice would you give them?
Treat your career the same way that you treat the assets of the organization that you're trying to protect. Your career is your own personal asset. And if you start taking on more liability than you have protection for, you are setting yourself up for an imbalanced risk equation, and you're setting yourself up to be bitten. So think about, any opportunity that you take. As it is a risk evaluation. And if you are taking on liability, you need to have the protections to counteract or offset or mitigate that liability. And you want that in writing, whether that employment contract, D&O insurance, whether you're an officer of the company, all of those kinds of things. Those are things that when you have a conversation or an interview and you actually make the case for those things, you're going to come across as more informed, as more experienced, because these things are real. They're not something that you're just making up to try to argue your way into a more senior position. These are real risks.
Yeah, I agree. Just adding on what you said earlier, it sounds like you would also include soft skills, polishing the soft skills.
Absolutely,
Okay.
absolutely. It's all part of, understanding the business and negotiation.
Yeah, fantastic. Really good stuff, great insights, really good tips. So before we wrap up, I know you're now out of the CISO role. So what's going on now? What are you doing?
Sure. So it's kind of funny, especially going back, and this circles back to the beginning of our conversation here. When I was facilitating a lot of industry conversations, we had government, academia, utilities, vendors, consultants, everybody under the sun in these industry working groups. And it was the vendors that always drove me crazy because it felt like they wanted to dominate and steer the conversation. And I'm just like, hey, there are other people in the room. And so I was always kind of drawn to the asset owner or utility side of the equation. Well, and I gave vendors an awful lot of grief. Well, now I'm paying for it because now I am a vendor. I have after I left Norfolk Southern, I went back into consulting. Was fully thinking, hey, this is I've done this before. I'm ready to go back and do it again. And sure enough, a technology found me that I realized, wow, I would have really liked to have had this in my shop when I was a CISO. And it was really some folks that didn't quite understand how to connect the dots between the technology and the business opportunity and the problems that it would solve. And they realized that, hey, Darren was somebody that could help connect those dots. So I am now CEO of Anchored. We are doing a novel approach to secrets management that allows you to move secrets away from the attack surface and essentially turn that attack surface from liability into insulation from attack. So
Okay, so you went from CISO to consulting to startup as a vendor.
I did,
Okay. Of some new technology that is not seen before. So you're bringing fire back to the cave even with your new startup. You are ambitious, my friend.
It is, and yeah, I mean, it is every bit of all of the cliches that you hear. It's you gotta start from from the ground, and you're rubbing sticks together to try to create fire, and it's a big hill to climb, but.
Yeah, you jump off the cliff with the box of parts and build the plane before you hit the ground. Yeah. Okay.
That's it. That's it.
Okay. Well, I certainly
So.
wish you the best of luck. So how can they find you? I'll put all this in the show notes too, but just in case you're listening.
Yeah. No, I will admit I've still got the tinfoil hat on, and I don't do a ton of social media stuff. The one bit of social media that I do is LinkedIn.
Okay.
You can find me on LinkedIn pretty easily, and I do post a fair amount of thoughts there. I've now started actually putting stuff on the Anchored blog and then linking to it from LinkedIn. So, but regardless, you can reach out directly, either contact me through Anchored or through LinkedIn. Or I'm not that hard to find,
Okay.
but certainly would welcome anybody that wants to reach out.
Yeah, just in case someone's like, hey, he said smart stuff and I want to go talk to him. So I want to make sure they had a way to find you. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, my friend, for giving us your wisdom from the field as a CISO. I know there's a bunch of professionals out there that are either going to get validated or hopefully going to learn something. Or hey, maybe they just like rabidly disagree and they're going to find you on LinkedIn and tell you about it. But I really appreciate
Like
the
a fun
time and the
conversation.
wisdom. Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Patrick. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the AMPIX Cyber Critical Assets Podcast. You can find us on all your favorite podcast sources, so please like, subscribe, and share with your colleagues. Check out our other content, such as blogs, news, and more at ampixcyber.com. That's ampixcyber.com. AMPIX Cyber, securing your world.